Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
We're in the South Bank Centre.
We've got a packed podcast again. We're going to talk about Tour Down Under in the first part, and then we're going to move on to the Tour de San Luis and a bit of debate about dirty tricks. Finally, we're going to talk a little bit about The Armstrong Lie, the film that I think is in cinemas from the end of this week.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So the Tour Down Under finished at the weekend. A win for Simon Gerrans, Orica GreenEdge, who have been on a real roll since last Tour de France, in last year's tour. We might claim some responsibility for that because we dismissed them completely at the start of the tour, didn't we, Daniel?
Yeah.
And then suddenly it just their fortunes changed and they haven't really looked back since then. But Lionel, you were glued to the Tour Down Under. What were your thoughts on the race? First World Tour race of the new season.
It was entertaining and exciting in a sort of semi-domestic kind of way, in a way that, say, the Tour of Britain was last year, with sort of Wiggins going for the overall. It was a very Aussie affair. I think it finished on Australia Day, so It was an opportunity for the Adelaide fans to see their big hitters. Gerrans, Richie Porte won the Willunga Hill stage, which is kind of becoming the Mur de Huy of Adelaide, I suppose. It's the one stage that they've inserted that's got an uphill finish, and it brings all
little
the climbers
hairpin
out.
Hairpin bends as well.
Yeah,
you know that.
Looks,
it's got a
looks
real
fantastic
alpine.
On TV.
Yeah.
Obviously Cadel Evans, who, as we should point out, would have won overall had it not been for the time bonuses that Gerrans got. So it was an exciting week's racing. Always difficult, I think, to get that excited in the middle of January.
Here we go.
There's a long way to go. Let's see how this,
I'm more interested. Gerrans or Gerrans?
Well, I think Gero is the nickname, isn't it? So
is
I assume
Gero.
Gero, mate.
Gero.
Truth, mate. Gero, mate.
Is it Gerrans or Gerrans? Daniel, I've always said Gerrans.
Also, what does he say?
I don't know what he says, actually. You don't
what does Gero say, mate? What does Gero say?
Just a word on Cadel Evans. You know, we've been writing him off maybe since 2011 when he won his tour. He's what, 36 now, he's sort of nearing the end of his career. But again, he showed great form. You know, so early in the season, he looks as strong as he's ever looked in January, certainly.
Well, I think the reason for that, and the reason that Port looks so good, is because their season kind of peaks with the Giro, which starts in first week of May. So.
Well, does it for Evans as well? I mean, is he not wanting to go lead the team at the tour as well?
He's talking about the Giro first, isn't he? So presumably will want to be taking a sort of step-by-step building towards that, perhaps through Tirreno, Adriatico, and then some of the classics, and then Tour Romandy perhaps even, and then the Giro.
It is interesting, and we'll talk about Tour de San Luis, obviously won by Nairo Quintana, but it's interesting to see the big hitters in such good form, winning form so early in the season, isn't it? I mean, this is in the 80s you saw that, but in the 90s and the early 2000s you didn't see so much of that.
Yeah, I think to an extent that's true. I mean, I remember a lot of stage finishes in the Tour of the Med, for instance, a sort of traditional curtain raiser, but that tended to take place later in the year, sort of, and it still does, mid-February. A lot of summit finishes on Montferrand, which gave good pointers towards the classics, but also towards the stage race season, you know, people like Vandenbroek winning there, Rebellin, etc. But yeah, they do seem to be hitting form very early, certainly the Aussies, similar to what used to happen with the Tour of California. You know, the sort of native riders would really target that race, and the Australians, for them, it's obviously a big deal. But Evans, I think, is just proving what a fantastic professional he's been throughout his career. I think he's lost some and will continue to lose some consistency. We've seen sort of flickers of his old self in the last couple of years, but he's perhaps going to struggle. I think he might struggle over 3 weeks at the Giro. I think he'll probably have the odd dicey day.
He's just he's a rider that has always been a diesel engine. He's strong. To see him straining up Willunga Hill at the weekend there, he's the Evans of old, and it's that sort of ability that doesn't perhaps diminish so much with age. He's never been an explosive rider.
No.
So, you know, he's maybe got another year or so left in the tank.
Yeah, I would say so. It's interesting that, you know, to contrast him with other riders of the same ilk, similar attitude, like someone like Ivan Basso, who also a fantastic professional, has a sort of monastic existence. But Basso has certainly struggled more, although he performed well at the Vuelta last year. He's kind of struggled to sustain.
He seems to be in a sharper decline.
And yet Basso is kind of more determined, I think, than Evans to carry on for a number of years. And Basso has talked about, you know, retiring beyond the age of 40, but I think he might struggle to sustain, you know, his current level beyond the next couple of years.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freed.
You guys were really getting stuck into each other before we started this podcast on the subject of time bonuses. I didn't realise it was such an emotive topic, but Daniel, you feel very strongly that time bonuses are a good thing. As you mentioned, Lionel, Simon Gerrans wouldn't have won the Tour Down Under without time bonuses, but you're against time bonuses. So we're going to start a sort of debate segment.
The heated debate. Order!
Each of you got a minute to argue your point. Lionel, you can go first. Why do you think time bonuses are a bad thing in capital letters? 3, 2, 1, go.
Oh, right, okay. We need a whistle. Time bonuses, for those who are who don't know, they are awarded either at the end of stages to the first three over the line or at intermediate sprints, and they're deducted from the overall standing time towards the overall classification. Now, to my mind, a stage race, whether it be a grand tour like the Tour de France or the Vuelta España, or a week-long stage race like the Tour Down Under, is the idea is to see who covers the course in the quickest aggregate time.
30 seconds.
Not who covers the course in the quickest aggregate time, minus a few little deductions here and there. Probably the most famous example recently of a result that was completely distorted was the Vuelta that Juan José Cobo won, where Chris Froome, who was the runner-up, actually rode round Spain in the quickest time. And so Cadel Evans can feel a little bit hard done by because...
5 seconds.
Because he completed the Tour Down Under in the quickest time and should be the winner.
Daniel, come in there and argue the case for time bonuses.
All right, well, this is going to be easy like Sunday morning.
God.
Lionel Richie. I told you, didn't I? It was going to be a weekly theme.
Lionel Richie song.
Easy like Sunday. Yes, it was. Did he? You know nothing about...
I think it was the,
you know nothing about anything that's not inspired by middle-class teenage angst. Anyway, right, time bonuses.
Daniel, go.
So, I'm a big advocate of time bonuses, simply because, Lionel, I think ideally, yes, the rider who completes the course in the least amount of time would win races, but I think you sacrifice the spectacle in a lot of stages by not having time bonuses. If, for instance, there is a guy away in a break who poses no threat on general classification, so often, and particularly in the Grand Tours, we've seen that a group of leaders behind will just kill the race and they'll have no incentive to
30 seconds.
Race towards the finish because there is no reason to. For some reason, the stage that is seared onto my memory is 2008 Tour de France stage finish in Bagnères de Bigorre, Ricardo Rico's famous attack on the Aspin, and behind the stage just was an absolute non-event because everyone had decided that there was no point in racing over the Aspin, big Pyrenean stage that was completely sacrificed, and we've seen that several times over the last few years.
Brilliantly timed, Daniel. Can't believe you're invoking Ricardo Rico in your argument. I have the casting vote here, so I've decided that, Daniel, you're right. Time bonuses are a good thing.
I didn't have time to add.
We can expand on it a little bit, but I understand, I think Lionel's got a kind of purist argument, and Daniel's got a sort of entertainment argument. I suppose that's this cuts to the heart of a lot of the debate around bike racing, how it's structured, how it's organised.
Also, from the point of view of entertainment, is it not more interesting, for instance, in a major tour to see the leader's jersey changing hands as a result of time bonuses several times in the first week?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, you can make a good case for it, but if we're going to take professional cycling down more the route of the entertainment route, which may well happen we may talk about this in future weeks, Project Avignon, the major teams coming together to revamp and revitalise a lot of the aspects of professional racing. Why not rather than having just time bonuses, why not have a hot kilometre or something like that, where you have a time segment?
Why not have cheerleaders, fireworks?
Look, I don't like the sound of
honestly,
that.
Razzmatazz.
This is where the sport is going to go in the coming years, with the rise of Strava and all of the kind of things that are steering participation in cycling. Christian Prudhomme even alluded to it this week when he said the key now for an event like the Tour de France is to tap into that huge growth in participation.
Yeah, he seemed very reluctant to embrace, you know, time bonuses, for example.
True. He got rid of them in the Tour de France. But you could imagine a race in future where there will be something like the hot kilometre, where the fastest.
I mean,
they
have done this in the Tour in the past. You know, that innovations like the you were talking recently, Lionel, about the a team time trial as a stage in the Tour in 88. Maybe was it?
It was the preface, which was held on
Thursday night or something.
Yeah, it was held the night before, because the town that had won the right to host the opening stage was too small, basically, to have a prologue. It was a little hamlet. I can't remember the name now. I'd need to look this up. I think, was it Machecoul?
I'll look it up.
A little small hamlet on the west of France won the right to host the 1988 Tour. Wasn't big enough for a prologue. So they were going to have a road stage just rolling out in the morning, as we've seen in the Cholet region recently. So no prologue, but Tour organisers and sponsors were not keen on the fact that the Tour would roll out of town. It was the town that hosted the start was Pontchâteau. The organisers were not keen on not having the yellow jersey rolling out in the opening road stage. So they decided to have a preface, which was basically a 1 kilometre, or it was a 7 kilometre team time trial, but the first 6 kilometres were not timed. The final 1 kilometre of each team's effort, one rider basically went off. So it was like a giant lead out, and then one rider from that team covered the final kilometre, and the quickest rider over that kilometre wore the yellow jersey. And those times didn't count towards the overall standings at all, but it was just a way to put the yellow jersey on the shoulders of somebody. And it was Guido Bontempi, an Italian riding for Carrera, who was the quickest over that kilometre.
The times from that stage didn't count for anybody, though?
They didn't count. It was purely to determine who would wear the yellow jersey the following morning when they rolled out on a regular road stage.
I mean, Lionel, if we were going to nitpick, and this is maybe overly pedantic, but even without time bonuses, the guy who finishes first is not the guy who necessarily covers the ground in the least amount of time, because, you know, a big bunch rolls in, everyone gets the same time. We have things like the 3 kilometre rule with mechanical problems and crashes. So it's kind of a false construct.
A false purity.
Yeah.
An impure purity.
Yeah. You're right. My argument has been
It's the beauty of bike racing, that there are these quirks, and you know the bunch rule is an interesting one, because you know a 1 second split in the bunch that has, you know, 1 second gap between wheels in the middle of the bunch that has nothing to do with you whatsoever can lose you 15 seconds on a fast stage if the bunch is strung out.
Yeah, that's so true. I suppose then my argument would be more towards saying some of these innovative rules that I'm sure that the people that are seeking to sort of power grab the way the sport is structured, they will consider various elements.
So being against time bonuses, would you be in favour of hot kilometres and things like that?
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether it's a case of necessarily being in favour of things like that. I just think it's going to happen. I can see everything pointing towards the major races being quite dramatically shifted in the next 10 years. I think there's going to be some innovative ideas. I think that things like that will begin to become we've talked, I think, on the Tour last year that the King of the Mountains competition is dying, and that probably the next way to reinvigorate it would be to have it as a timed competition where maybe you know, certain key mountains or certain
incorporating something like Strava.
Yeah, basically. I mean, if Strava came along and said, look, we want to invest, you know, $10 million in a cycling event.
Buying this idea off us and then going to the Tour
de France. You heard it here first.
Then this would happen overnight, and there'd be, you know, nobody would turn down investment from a huge growing company like that.
I mean, if we're going to look at bike racing as a saleable commodity, thinking about how it's sold to television companies, a 5 or 6 hour transitional stage in the middle of a grand tour, which is going to mean absolutely nothing for the general classification. You know, there are good reasons to spice it up a bit in the middle of the stage, and we've seen that with how the green jersey competition has been reinvigorated by the redistribution of points, and now the intermediate sprints are so much more important, and suddenly you've got something to watch 2-3 hours into the stage. And you know, there's no reason, I don't think, why in future we won't see time bonuses maybe distributed throughout the stage. I know, you know, in the past we've had time bonuses at intermediate sprints, but more of that in future.
I've spoken to Dave Brailsford about this kind of reorganisation of the sport and in the coming years, and one of the ideas, he mentioned this maybe 2-3 years ago, but one of the ideas that he was sort of throwing around, I'm not necessarily saying he's a sort of advocate for this necessarily, but the idea of the Tour de France being a kind of squad game where, you know, his point was, do we need to see Mark Cavendish haul himself over the Alps and the Pyrenees where he's not affecting the race at all? Could we not have a situation where a squad of 12 went to the Tour and 8 of them were selected on any given
teams.
Morning? Yeah. And so,
that'd be good, wouldn't it?
A bit like NFL, special teams. And if you want to qualify for the overall, obviously you have to do every stage.
Mm.
But if you want to just pick and choose certain targets, you know, you could imagine...
Because effectively, an awful lot, probably a majority of the Tour field, are only really competing in, or only really racing 6 or 7 stages.
I've often thought, you know, that a lot of riders in the pro peloton are paid quite a lot of money by teams, and what do those teams actually really... get out of them a lot of the time?
Yeah.
What do they get out of themselves? Anyway, we'll leave it there. I'm sure we'll return to this, but that was an excellent first heated debate, chaps. Well played, both of you.
Is that 1-0 to Daniel?
We'll call it a draw.
Okay.
Maybe we'll let the listeners decide. You can tweet in what you think and hashtag heated debate.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
So the Tour de San Luis, which we talked about last week, the new stage race in Argentina, which has been growing in prestige the last few years, but unlike Tour Down Under, it's not a World Tour race, so it's got a real, more of a mix of teams and riders and abilities, I suppose, and a large local contingent. And there were a few controversies and incidents that happened there that that our colleague Neil Rogers in Velo News wrote about in an excellent and very measured piece, just drawing attention to some incidents that are perhaps commonplace throughout the sport of cycling and at all levels, but don't often get talked about as much as doping, which dominates when we come to talking about cheating in cycling. But to run through a couple of the alleged incidents, Enzo Maiano, the local favourite, was pushed by spectators and perhaps holding onto motorbikes as well, press motorbikes. This is alleged, obviously. And the suggestion was that these weren't isolated incidents, but they were a concerted effort to actually help him, and he was challenging for GC. He wasn't just trying to survive in the race. And Kenny Dehaese was allegedly also punched by Walter Perez, the Argentinian Olympic gold medalist from 2008. They didn't file any kind of complaint about that. His team Lotto Belisol decided not to complain, and that drew some criticism from some quarters as well. But what did you make of that, Lionel or Daniel, who wants to talk about these incidents in Argentina, but also more widely these kind of things that do go on?
Yeah, it is very common. We'd be naive to say that it wasn't common. Well, certainly the taking pulls, a lot of riders taking toes. Now, it's a matter of opinion whether, I mean, in this particular case, it was a rider who could conceivably have won the overall classification. So it was obviously seemed more significant, but in any given, certainly mountain stages, that there are usually accusations that someone is either drafting behind team cars unfairly or taking toes. But, you know, what we often see is that that seems the only purpose that seems to serve is to save energy for someone or get them inside the time limit, but that can also have a major impact on the outcome of a race, because 2 days later that same rider is winning a stage or contending for a stage. But it's very, very difficult to police, isn't it? And often the accusations are based on hearsay, you know, someone in a team car saw someone else hanging on to another team car. I mean, there was a rider, Mattia Gavazzi, was booted out of the Giro d'Italia this year for hanging on to a car, and the evidence presented before the UCI commissaires was a picture taken on another Director Sportif's camera phone. And it does tend to get a little bit sort of vindictive at times as well.
I wonder, is there a difference between a rider, a sprinter battling to survive in the mountains, holding on to a team car or getting a lot of pushes? Is there a moral difference between that and a rider who is in contention overall?
I don't think so. I mean, in this case, it seems to me that the majority of the pushes being talked about as well were from fans, which, okay, is regrettable, but it's understandable as well, given that it was an Argentine rider, and the majority of the fans, obviously, were Argentine. So they were, and that happens everywhere. Mm-hmm. Happens in any race, doesn't it? And there's not a lot the rider can do to stop that. You know, they can bat away the hands, and but obviously it's a different matter when it's motorbikes or cars that they're taking tows from.
Should point out here that, you know, we were talking earlier, one of the most, in a lot of people's view, the greatest Tour de France of all time, the 1989 Tour, and certainly the closest Tour of all time, won by Greg LeMond. LeMond claimed at the time and later that Laurent Fignon had held onto a motorbike on one stage in the Pyrenees, and, you know, he obviously went very, very close to winning that Tour. So, you know, LeMond, quite unusual to speak up about it. I suspect it happens more than we realise, more than we know about.
I think the difficulty with the sort of history of the sport, you can go back through plenty of examples. I mean, there's stories of riders taking shortcuts in the Tour of Flanders probably the most famous Giro d'Italia, where Francesco Moser was basically blown from behind by a television helicopter in the decisive time trial, and it was Laurent Fignon, a Frenchman, who missed out. The history of the sport is kind of based on the idea and the notion that the home riders, it's good for business, it's good for the races, it's good for the sponsors, it's good for everybody that the home riders perform well and ideally win. And I think one of the biggest changes in the sort of the mondialisation, the globalisation of the sport has been that the UCI has, for all of its various flaws, it has internationalised, and its commissaires now are, you know, broadly speaking, you know, they are now independent. It's not French people judging the riders in the Tour de France and turning a blind eye to something Bernardino does whilst penalising Johan van der Velde of the Netherlands, for example. There's no specific example in that case, but certainly, even in the mid to late 80s, there was a sense from foreign riders that going and racing at the Vuelta in Spain was very much like an away fixture, having to take on not just
1985, Pedro Delgado, when he escaped the penultimate day into his hometown with Robert Miller in the leader's jersey, and you know there were suspicions then, even at the time, of foul play, and Delgado getting some help from the motorbikes and the cars, you know, even some shelter.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, Sean Kelly, who was kind of roped in to help Robert Miller. I mean, they had the same agent, and they were foreigners racing in Spain, and they liked each other. And Kelly and some of his teammates tried to help Robert Miller out, who didn't, you know, wouldn't have had any friends among the rest of the Spanish teams. But yeah, the suspicion there was that the timekeeping motorbike deliberately didn't give any accurate information, so kept the time gaps quite small on the chalkboard for a long, long time. Whether or not they knew that the time gap had leapt up to 10 or 11 minutes is open for debate, but the accusation
is... the best aspect of that story, which has just come back to me, is the two team... because Miller had a puncture on a climb and got back on with the help of two teammates, but those two teammates didn't get back on, but they were about to catch his group again when a level crossing came down and stopped them. and no train ever appeared.
Yeah, and I mean, even in 1987 and 88, when Kelly would have won the Vuelta in 87 had it not been for a saddle boil, and in 88 he did win the Vuelta riding for a Spanish team. The kind of the home nations combine was still very much a factor of those races. You know, somebody on a small Spanish team would help out the bigger BH team, which had four potential Spanish winners in that team. So going up against all these cultural alliances and different interests, you know, the bunch in any race is a society on wheels. And if you're on home soil, there's going to be all of these various different aspects coming into play. And it's up to the commissaires and the race organisers to have a strong neutral line on it. And perhaps, in a race in Argentina at the moment, you know, there isn't yet the infrastructure that there is, for example, in the Tour Down Under or in more established and sort of more mature races, perhaps.
I think it's worth pointing out, Lionel, as well, you said society on wheels there, the peloton. And in general, these days, I feel that the peloton is quite effective at policing itself, in the sense that often action is taken on the basis of complaints from other riders, and the complaints are only really made when they feel that a genuine injustice has been committed. And if action isn't taken immediately, then what happens is that it tends to be taken, you know, in the next stage or in the next race. The commissaires will keep a closer eye on a particular rider because there have been murmurs that rider has taken toes.
Yeah, and we're kidding ourselves if it doesn't go on. I mean, a certain team owner who's not currently involved in the sport used to drop some large hints about riders on other teams holding onto cars and so on in the mountains.
You're not talking about Bob there, in very recent years.
maybe. Just the comment, Jackson Stewart was the BMC director who Neil Rogers spoke to for his piece, and he was talking about Miano. He says he was getting pushed by everyone. I saw at least four fans run and push him. In the last 700 metres, I saw a press bike roll up and just shove him right back up. So, that's something that's happening at the front of the race. We really should, you know, that should be captured by TV cameras and so on. But even at the back of the race, in this day of smartphones and so on, you'd have thought there'd be fewer hiding places. There'd be fewer places where even a back marker could.
Yeah, I mean, what tends to happen is there are days when a consensus seems to develop for some reason that it is okay and everyone is doing it and no one complains, no one takes any umbrage. But whereas there are other days when for some reason, you know, there could be one rider who is just having an awful time at the back and is struggling bravely to make a time cut, and he sees someone appear over his shoulder looking as fresh as a daisy, and that's when noses start to get put out of joint and people get angry.
I think, wasn't it a couple of years ago in the Giro when some of the Italians claimed that Mark Cavendish was hanging on to bikes or cars, and he made the point that, you know, for him, often he sees other people getting a push or getting a toe and it kind of goes unpunished, but his quote was something like, "I'm back there with TV cameras and a marching band," and the spotlight's really strongly on the bigger names, and perhaps the lesser riders get away with it a bit more.
Chris Froome as well, of course, 2010.
Yeah, that was a slightly different case though, because he was left without a team car support. His knee, I think, was giving him a lot of grief, and he just wanted to get to where he knew the soigneurs were waiting so he could abandon the race, and he held onto a motorbike to get up the last few K of the climb. I mean, that was his argument, his excuse, and I mean, he did abandon the race anyway. So, I mean, we can all cite examples of things happening. But
full disclosure. Should I do full disclosure?
I think you probably should, Richard. Yeah.
If I don't, someone will point it out, I'm sure. But I was disqualified once in the RAS in Ireland in 1996 after crashing early on stage 7 in torrential rain. It hurt my knee, very like Chris Froome, actually. Very similar scenario. I was about 15 minutes off the back, and the team car came back from me. I held on the team car for a bit, and I was disqualified. To be honest, I was wanting to pack the race anyway. Honestly, but again, you know, I didn't.
What nationality was the commissar?
Irish.
If you'd been Scottish, I think you'd have got away with it.
Couldn't possibly say, Daniel. I still see that commissar around, actually. Mickey Robb, fearsome man. But, yeah, it's. I certainly didn't regard that scene, because I was trying to maybe get back to the bunch if I could. There was chances of that were very, very slim. You know, I would make a moral sort of distinction between that, obviously, and a kind of cheating to even, you know, stay within a time limit or
something.
But
then if you go on and win a stage,
you're right, and
I think the thing in Argentina is it's difficult because it's the fans pushing their favourite on the climb.
Yeah.
So
no one was pushing me.
We see that it's different in the Tour de France. The pushing has really, I mean, in the 80s and 90s, it was every day, all day. You'd see people pushing everybody. But the fans have kind of changed their behaviour. They don't put their hands on the riders as much anymore. You don't see people getting a push. The commissaire cars tend to manage to get the crowds out of the way a little bit more. But I mean, in a race like in Argentina, where there isn't full-day TV coverage, it's not as surprising.
There's a fixed camera on the line.
And it still does happen as well when there's a feeling, almost a palpable sense among the riders that the course is too hard. And, you know, if you in stages like races like the Tirreno Adriatico, it's common now to get 1 or 2 days with 25% climbs, and generally on those days you'll find that all but the top 20 riders are getting some kind of push from the crowd. I remember Carlos de Cruz, the La Française des Jeux rider, used to say that, you know, if you really grimaced, if you put on a real kind of a face which suggested you were really suffering, then you always got... Yeah, he just used to do that gratuitously because he always used to get a push.
He was also sort of renowned as being at the Tour primarily for the...
I think we mentioned that
for the podcast. The gourmet experience, yeah. No?
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Final part of this week's podcast. We're just going to talk briefly about the Armstrong Lie, which we've mentioned before in the pod, but it's worth revisiting because it's in cinemas from this week, I think, from Friday. Two of us have seen it. Lionel, you're looking forward to seeing it, I think.
Yeah, I couldn't go when the screening was on in London, so I've seen the trailers and I've read a lot about it, and I know, obviously, Alex Gibney's work with the Enron film. So I'm quite looking forward to getting a bucket of popcorn and seeing what it's all about.
Daniel, you saw it. I saw it in Florence at the World Championships. You saw it, I think, here in London. What were your thoughts about it?
I mean, from purely, I suppose, a technical point of view, it was quite a big, unwieldy story to try and package into, I don't know how long the film
is. 2 hours. 2 hour
feature film. And it does really try to cover everything. Some fantastic footage of a young Armstrong talking about whipping people's asses or some words to that effect when he was about 14, 15, I think, started doing triathlons. And it goes right through really to the end. So the end of 2012 when he was finally sort of exposed. And within that, the story is kind of hung on the 2009 Tour de France, his comeback tour. And yeah, it goes off in a lot of different directions. There's nothing, I suppose, from an investigative point of view that is new. I think it will appeal for that reason mainly to... the sort of uninitiated people who didn't really follow the story closely, would you say, Rich?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I felt like it was two films in one, really. The footage, it is, I suppose, because it started life as a film of a documentary following Armstrong in his comeback year in 2009. That's what Gibney... that was the film that he began making. A decision that led to some criticism from Greg LeMond, among others, for, you know... hitching his wagon to Armstrong when they felt the evidence against him was already very strong, obviously. So, you know, and I think that creates one of the problems in the film, because it's almost like he's apologising for that throughout the film. And, you know, the footage mainly is from Armstrong's comeback year in 2009 and a little bit from 2010 as well. And I find that footage compelling, you know, the behind-the-scenes stuff with Alberto Contador at the 2009 tour was brilliant.
You get the feeling that a brilliant film could have been made solely about that.
And just almost, you know, we know what happened. We know now the truth. He's got this new interview with Armstrong as well. Let that speak for itself. I think there's a little bit too much moralising from Gibney, and a little bit too much sort of self-justification. And in interviews that I've seen with him as well, it's almost as though he was most concerned about his reputation, having made the film. And I think as you say, there was the footage was there to make a great film anyway, and to let the facts speak for themselves. I think what he could have done as well was highlight just how difficult it was, even for somebody who was embedded with Armstrong in 2009, how difficult it was to get to the truth of what was going on. That might have been a more interesting film in some ways, but I don't know. I felt that there was also a problem for me in that this footage from 2009 showed Armstrong not the Armstrong of old. He was defeated, he was slightly diminished, grey hairs and so on, and he was being beaten by Contador. So on the one hand you had this footage of Armstrong the athlete but not at his best and being beaten, but on the other hand you were being told all the time that he was this, you know, evil bully, and it didn't quite add up.
Is it a bit like the moment in Return of the Jedi when Darth Vader takes the mask off and,
yeah,
and he's a big podgy
like
teddy bear underneath?
A little bit similar to that. Yeah I mean, I think there was some good a few too many talking heads as well, not name any names, but the stuff from George Hincapie was good because we've not heard from him at all, but his input and his total lack of remorse was quite interesting. He was very matter of fact about what had gone on, which we've not really heard. I mean, from an investigative point of view, I suppose we haven't heard from him before.
Yeah, I think that, like I said before, that the kind of hardened fan will perhaps be less interested in the sort of overall narrative and will take some interesting nuggets that we didn't previously know from the film. Things that stand out are, well, certainly the footage of that kind of portrays the Armstrong Contador rivalry in 2009. There's some really sort of quite revealing snapshots there. Also, Michele Ferrari is a bit
yes.
of a bit of a star
yes.
of the film. It comes across as obviously quite charismatic with the sort of evil, malevolent streak that we all know. One thing that...
I don't know, because that's the thing. I mean, I'd never seen Ferrari really
yeah.
on screen before
yeah,
and
yeah.
talking so much.
One thing that I certainly remember from the film is Ferrari talking about the 2005 tour and just one line about how, most of you will remember that wasn't Armstrong's necessarily his most dominant performance. He didn't really attack with the same sort of force and
2005
in the mountains. Mm,
he didn't
excel in the mountain stages to the same extent as he had in previous tours. But Ferrari said that he was basically deliberately not going too hard in that tour because that was his best form or his best performance ever from a physiological point of view, and that he could have won by almost double the margin if he'd wanted to, but he didn't, purely not to arouse too much suspicion.
It was a very controlled performance,
yeah.
wasn't it? There was one day in the Vosges, I remember, where it looked as though T-Mobile was a much stronger outfit that year, but a couple of days later the US postal guys were flying.
Where Clody almost took him to the cleaners, didn't he? On
he
the Col de la Schlucht.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. Well, I think that's probably it for this week. Enjoy the Armstrong Live if you go to see it. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Lionel, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.